Hello, and welcome to the Weekly Comic Spotlight on the Comic Book Page podcast. My name is John Mayer. In this episode, we'll be discussing recently released comics. One from DC, one from Marvel, and at least one other. As always, we'll keep major spoilers to a minimum, but we'll discuss general plot points and storylines of the comics we review. This is Weekly Comics Spotlight, 456 for comics originally released on May 4th, 2016. Now, starting us off in DC is Scooby-Doo Team-Up number 16. Now, this is a title that we heard a number of good things about from some of our listeners when we did the yearly comics spotlight at the end of 2015. So that got this book kind of on my radar. I'm a fan of the Shazam family, so when I saw this issue in previews, I'm like, hey, I should pre-order this. And you know what the heck, we're going to go ahead and review it now. I have not read any of the previous 15 issues of this. I don't remember the last time I watched any Scooby-Doo stuff or any kind of Shazam cartoons or whatever. But, you know, I'm a fan of the Shazam family and stuff. I love the cover art here. This is just some really cool stuff. It's got the cartoon vibe down with kind of, oh, here's the background, here's another layer with the moving art type stuff. I felt this comic really got that kind of Saturday morning cartoon vibe down perfectly. And for any younger listeners that have no idea what I'm talking about, I am so sorry. It was a great aspect of our culture that died away with I don't know if it was just cable TV or what exactly killed Saturday morning cartoons. It's a shame. This just, the art really looks like a cartoon from kind of that era. I'm thinking, you know, 80s, give or take, in a good way, not in a, geez, it's, you know, cheesy art or anything. It's like they nailed the model sheets and stuff perfectly on this stuff. And I felt the writing really captured the sense of the characters. The whole concept of kind of teaming up the Captain Marvel Shazam family with the Scooby-Doo gang, not something that would have come to my mind. But I felt they were very faithful to the source material. Again, this being more the cartoon version of the Marvel family. But I think that also means either you're going to really like this or you just might hate it, depending what you feel about, again, the Scooby-Doo gang and this the source material and that kind of stuff.
I think you hit it. Yeah, you've got to have buy-in with half of the team at least, right? You have to either be a fan of the Scooby-Doo gang. Or you have to like Shazam and company. And I happen to be a fan of Scooby-Doo. And so that was my linchpin for this. And you're right. It really felt faithful to the cartoon series. I liked the characterizations of the characters. And they seemed to be true to what they were in, on Saturday mornings and DVD collections, etc. Now, Sholly Fish, the writer, is a name I've heard before. Did he or she do some Green Arrow? Is that where I heard that name? Do you know?
I don't know. That's an excellent question.
But it's a DC New 52 writer, I think. I think that writer had some time, spent some time in New 52 as well. So,
okay.
Artist I wasn't familiar with.
Dario Brazzulia?
Yeah.
Maybe. Neither of the creators rang any bells with me, but I'm not really good on remembering the creator names if they're not, you know, kind of embedded in my brain somehow. Mm-hmm.
It was much more heavy towards the Scooby-Doo world than it was. It could have been a team up with anybody, I felt. I felt it was more like those Scooby-Doo cartoons where, you know, the Harlem Globetrotters come in or Gilligan's Island or whoever, you know, they would just bring somebody else in into their world and they would continue to do what they did. And it's what it just felt like an episode. And so I don't know if that's what they're going for, but that's what they accomplished.
Well, given the title is Scooby-Doo Team Up and not Shazam Family Team Up, I would kind of expect that.
Yeah, it's really not a half and half thing. It's much more 60-40, 70-30 in the Scooby vein. And they've been doing this a while. They did some stuff with since 2013. Is this how long this thing's been going on? I know they've done Batman and
it's a bi-monthly title, And I think it's a digital first thing as well. So the previous issue, I think, had Flash. They've done some others, teaming up with everything from, I think, the Jetsons on up and down. So clearly they're using the Scooby Gang to kind of introduce some of these other characters. And I think that's cool. I think it makes sense. I liked how they started with a, this is who, you know, the Captain Marvel family is, the what their acronyms, you know, what powers that gives them, that kind of stuff. Certainly the Scooby Gang was the stars of this, but I don't think the Shazam family was, you know, relegated to a second-tier status or anything. I mean, we get just about the entire Monster Society of evil and whatever.
Well, I guess I maybe didn't know what to expect with the team up. I didn't know if it would be Scooby in the DC world, the Scooby Gang in the DC world, or the DC world comes into the Scooby world. So I wasn't sure.
I was taking it as the Saturday morning cartoon world.
Yeah.
So it's not the DC universe or any aspect necessarily of it, but it's like if all those Saturday morning cartoons coexisted in some world or whatever, this is how it would all kind of piece together. You know, I for me, where it really, you know, it was fun and stuff, but when it got to the what was it, the biomolecular transmogrifier of Mr. Mimes, that's where the thing really kind of kicked into high gear there. Now, I don't know if Bill Watterson, creator of Calvin and Hobbes, gets royalties on the use of transmogrifiers or whatnot, because I'm not sure if he originated the term or not, but it's a great term. And man, when we get, let's see, Mr. Mime tries to turn Velma and Shaggy into monsters and stuff, where the story goes from there, to me, that's where it got to be a lot of fun. And yeah, you're right. It does feature heavily the Scooby Gang. It is their title. But then we actually get the Shazam family coming into play, doing some cool stuff. And then the explanation for, first off, not only how a couple of the villains get defeated of, you know, Eyeback and Cyback. I mean, that's...
That was very clever. I thought that was a very clever touch.
It's clever. It's fun. It's almost a by the numbers kind of a thing for those defeating those villains. But when we get the explanation of what really happened with Velma and Shaggy, I'm like, okay, that was just clever. That was fun. You know, there was a couple other moments, you know, a reference to, you know, stay away from those meddling kids. And Freddy's like, huh? Now it's like, oh, they were talking about Billy, Mary, and Freddy, the Shazam family, you know, pre-Shazamming, if you will. I thought that was fun. There were a few other Easter eggs here and there. The warehouse where the Monster Society was hanging out was at the corner of, Parker and Beck. And the Shazam family, or Shazam Captain Marvel at least, was created by writer Bill Parker and artist C.C. Beck. So it's okay. You know, nice little callback there.
Oh, nice.
But it felt like a really fun read. And I knew it would be kind of, you know, a fun Saturday morning throwback or whatever. But it really exceeded my expectations in a lot of respects. I mean, everything from when they're going through, here's the Monster Society of Evil, and they mention Mr. Banjo. He's like, well, he doesn't seem so bad. And then we get the you know, why he may be more serious than we think. It's like, okay, that was kind of fun. You know, there was a good back and forth between, and, you know, a lot of the Shazam family that gets featured is Uncle Marvel and Talkie Tawny and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But there was a good back and forth between all of them. It really exceeded my expectations considerably.
Yeah, I thought it was a really solid read. I thought it was good. I'm curious as to, I think this is a good fit for someone who's looking for an all ages title to read that is looking for spirit of fun in their comics and a throwback to Saturday morning cartoon storytelling. You know, if somebody's missing that, this is a good fit for your pull list. Or a palate cleanser, like as we were talking about last week with Squirrel Girl and Howard the Duck, how they kind of fill that void. I think this would be a good fit right alongside that because it has the spirit of fun and it feels like a Saturday morning cartoon. But you got to know that going in because it's not going to be the same experience as reading Batman 51 or, you know, or some of the Rebirth titles that are coming up.
If you're looking for a more grim and gritty or darker type thing, this isn't it at all. It's something that you could share with your kids. I think kids would enjoy it, but I think it's truly an all-ages book. I enjoyed this immensely. You know, I thought it was a strong story. There was a lot going on. There's a lot of dialogue on some of these pages.
Is this something you're adding to your pull list?
Not only am I probably going to add it to my pull list, I very well may hunt down a lot of the back issues. I thought this was a lot of fun. You know,
Do those in trade, or are you going to try to pick up the single issues?
Don't know. Depends how easy the single issues are to get. You know, this, again, they captured the Scooby Gang perfectly, I thought. What they did with the Shazam family, I thought was a good introduction to them. Gave them just enough of the limelight. Clearly, they were the guest stars in the Scooby, you know, story here. But it was, it brought back a lot of fond memories of Saturday morning cartoons, and kind of the nature of those stories, and just a happier, simpler time of superheroes and whatnot. But
exactly that.
Yeah. You know, again, what they did with how the Scooby Gang interacted with the Marvel family near the end there and stuff, I thought was clever. I thought was fun. And, you know, I can totally see why this got so many mentions on the Yearly Comic Spotlight, this title. If this is the least bit representative of the series, and I've got to imagine that it is.
Yeah, I'm definitely going to go back and pick up that first trade and read that, and then probably read it that way. I don't know that I need to read it in single issue form, although it was a satisfying single issue. I think I'd just be just as happy as to have a trade that every once in a while, when I was in the mood for this sort of thing, I could just shift gears and pick up the trade and read it. But yeah, it was solid experience, and I would recommend it to folks that know going in what you're going to get and have that desire to read something like that.
Absolutely. And that's, again, a lot of it is, if you're not into the Scooby Gang, or you think they're stupid or something, or you're not into the Captain Marvel family, or whatever the guest star per issue is, this may not be for you. And if you're looking for something that's much more realistic or grim and gritty or dark or whatever, this totally isn't that. But that's also what I really liked about it, is this was a fun kind of simpler story or whatever. Not simpler story. Lighter tone, that's what I mean. A lighter tone than I get in a lot of the other books. And I had recalled seeing, I don't remember if it was in this previews or the previous one, that I think the next issue is going to have Hawkman and Hawkgirl, or Hawkwoman. It's like, okay, that seems like fun. I'd be down for that. So, you know, it's again, it may not be for everybody, but I think if it is the kind of thing you might be interested in, definitely check it out. For me, this was a total home run. It did, like I said, it treated all the characters and material with respect. It told a great story. It told a very full story. I felt we got a lot of story and value for a $2.99 comic, more so than most things that I read. So for me, I'm giving this an A+. It lived up to my expectations and then some. So I was very pleased with this.
I'm at a B+. I think this is a really good read, a lot of fun. It is not normally the genre that I gravitate towards, and so the experience was a little less enjoyable for me, but it still, I could see the spirit of fun and enjoy it, and I thought it was well executed.
I want to thank Perseus, Dr. Moe, and Clobbering Time BS from the forum. They all mentioned this title in their picks for the Yearly Comic Spotlight. That is what got this title, at least on my radar, led to me pre-ordering it and us reviewing it. So thanks, guys. This was a really good pick, and I totally get why they picked it. I think is the best all ages comic.
Yeah, I think you're right.
We need more comics like this, because I can totally see somebody coming out of this thinking, you know, this Marvel family, that's interesting. Maybe I should go learn more about them. And that's a way to get readers from one title to another.
Yeah, but in DC, they're not called Captain Marvel or...
Well, they're the Shazam family on the cover here, too. So... I would just be a little wary if somebody read this thinking, wow, Shazam's really cool. Hey, he's in this Justice League title, because he's not so cool of a character there. Shall we move on to our Marvel book?
Yeah.
This is Thunderbolts number 1. It's written by Jim Zub. We've got John Malin on the art. And I have fond memories of the original Thunderbolts number 1.
Many people do.
It was published in kind of the Dark Ages pre-internet. back when stories weren't as likely to get spoiled. I mean, they still could be, because some people would talk out of turn in interviews and stuff like that. But it's not like you had to go dark for a couple of days or whatever. Because that original one ended on just a game-changing note, and it's like, okay, that was cool. This is spinning out of the Assault on Pleasant Hill storyline, which I thought was a lot of fun. I appreciated how they didn't kind of abandon aspects of the past, like the Winter Soldier's role as the man on the wall, which I think is kind of a bizarre name for that role or whatever, but kept that in play, kept pretty much the core Thunderbolts group, very much the Thor Thunderbolts group. I think the only major change is the name that Mach 1, Mach 2, Mach 3, he's up to Mach X now, or Mach 10. Sooner or later, that's just going to get a little unwieldy, if Mach, 87 or something. But merging kind of the man-in-the-wall responsibilities to the Winter Soldier in with him leading this group of Thunderbolts, I thought was a really interesting decision, because it really gives them a good excuse to go kind of go do things and allows them to, I mean, the presumption is they're going to be fairly heroic here. That's not a done deal. It's not necessarily a given. But I thought it was a good premise for the series. I think Zub is a good writer, but I also think this issue was a little lacking in a few areas. It was solid story and art, but I think it could have done a little bit better job kind of establishing some of the characters and why we should care for them, and kind of maybe a little bit better overall direction for where this thing is going. What were your thoughts on this?
Yeah, I think this was a number one more for folks who have read that last Thunderbolts volume and wanted the next issue, maybe a revamping of that story again, because I didn't feel like this did a very good job of, I didn't read that last one, so of what it's all about. I mean, they gave you a little a capsule page and they tried to get the gang together and kind of show you each of the characters, but I thought it was very cursory. I didn't really get the team being together. I didn't really get their any kind of chemistry between them. I had a bit of a nitpick with the little girl, mm-hmm. Kobik. Yeah, I know 4-year olds. I've had a 4-year old. That is no 4-year old. They need to at least put it in an age range where a child would be that size, would speak that way. And then on top of that, of course, have godlike powers.
Yeah, I was going to say, was the 4-year-olds you've dealt with, were they manifestations of a cosmic cube? I think they age differently that way.
Well, that's dumb.
That's fair.
let's put it at least in the wheelhouse of what human, if you're going to have an approximation of a human child, at least put them in the age range that is realistic for that, the size and shape and manners of that child, or don't give it an age at all.
Not giving it an age was the simple solution. Given the look of the character, what age would you have put the character at?
6 or 7.
Okay, that's fair. That works.
That could have worked, and it wouldn't have bothered me so much.
It's funny, because that's literally like a one character change in one or two places.
Yeah.
It's...
And it bothered me throughout it. I was like, oh, come on. A 4-year-old's going to talk like that? No. 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 I couldn't get over it. It drove me nuts. And then, of course, some interesting actions by said child were unexpected at the end. I thought that was an interesting twist. But I didn't have a lot invested in these characters, because I didn't know them at all. The only one I really had any kind of sense of was Winter Soldier from other books, and so that person was easier to kind of get behind. And obviously, this is the person I'll be rooting for, because this is really the only one I know and I've spent enough time with to get to know. The rest of them, it was really, really surface, and them being together and working as a team really wasn't on the page anywhere.
Yeah, I think there's a lot kind of riding on the fact that most of these characters, the Thunderbolts themselves, have known each other for a long time, worked together for a long time, etc. Mixing in the Winter Soldier, who's very much kind of the front and center character here, is kind of ironic, given he's pretty much a major loner in a lot of respects. So suddenly, mm-hmm. he's a team lead, he's a father figure to this girl. It's like, where did this come from? It's fun, I liked it, but again, some of that wasn't quite on the page, and it could have and should have been. So I, like I said, I had some reservations about how they did some of the stuff here, and I don't know that somebody is going to come out of this thinking, wow, you know, the Fixer or Atlas or some of these other characters, they're great. I need more.
And they did. They had a nice panel at the end of the book that had much deeper bio on everyone, on who the characters are and were. And as a number one issue, I felt that could have been front loaded and really helped inside cover first page on, instead of this opening splash, maybe it could have been with the credits page. And that's something I would think that one of the editors, Tom Brevoort, is he one of them that is actually working on this?
Excellent question. Who is the editor on this?
It looks like it's Brevoort with Alana Smith listed as editor. So he's a heavy hitter.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think that would have helped as a number one issue, unless that's not their audience. Their audience is everyone who read the last one.
Well, I don't think it was the last one, because I think the last one may not have even been these characters. These are the characters from the original run of Thunderbolts.
Oh, okay.
There have been three or four majorly different takes of the Thunderbolts over the years and the decades.
Which one was the Peter David run? I was thinking that was the one that was fondly remembered.
Fabian Nicieza did the original run. That's one that was fondly remembered. There was then a, and I'm going to get these out of order. At one point, there was like a pro wrestling kind of thing for a few issues. That didn't go over well. Then there was the Luke Cage version running it out of the prison for a while. There was version okay. two between those of just...
These are all new. These are all volumes.
Oh, there were multiple volumes of this.
Multiple
yeah.
volumes. Okay.
And I think the last one...
I was not aware of that.
The last volume, and I may be off by volume here, there may have been one since, had the Red Hulk running a team that had Elektra, Punisher, maybe Deadpool.
Yeah, that was going on when I came back to comic. That run was still going, and I just assumed that was just the tail end iteration of the Thunderbolts as it had always existed, and it's just kind of evolved.
Oh, no. Thunderbolts, again, it originated back with the Heroes Reborn stuff back in the day. The Avengers, the Fantastic Four, a bunch of characters were thrown into that pocket dimension at the time, so the Image, couple of Image creators, Lee and Liefeld, could go run amok with them for about a year. During that time, what they did is they launched the Thunderbolts as if they were the new kind of Defenders or Champions or, you know, hero team du jour. It was a brilliant leveraging of an opportunity. Actually, Fabian Nicieza did it later. It was Kurt Busiek who started the title.
That was the name. Yeah.
Yeah. Wow. I'm surprised I got that wrong initially.
Heavy hitter.
Oh, God. Yeah. Totally heavy hitter. And he had not only a brilliant first issue, but a brilliant solicit for the first issue that had some meat to it. You read it. It was intentionally misleading, but accurate. It was a very, very well-written solicit and stuff. And I think there's a lot that they can do with this property, with these characters. Maybe we'll get that here eventually, but so far this was just setting the scene and stuff like that. There's a high bar to reach with this title of where the property's gone in the past. This didn't quite hit it. It had some fun stuff. But again, they should have done a better job establishing the characters. They should have taken that page at the end with those bios, done it at the beginning, and hey, coming out of the pages of Avengers Assault on Pleasant Hill or whatever, boom, here are the characters. Then go into the story. I think that would have worked. I think if they'd done that, people might have complained, hey, it's a first issue and they have a previously on, you know, kind of a deal, but it can't please anybody these days.
Yeah, I think the run I'm thinking of is the one that started in 97 and ran 174 issues from 97 to 2012.
That and sounds about right. I was thinking,
and then it must have had a second series.
Well, there was New Thunderbolts. I mean, they've had multiple volumes and again, multiple different takes on the team.
Yeah, but that one was the one I was thinking of, the one that ran 174 issues.
No, yeah, it was a great title at one point. It lasted for a long time, did some cool stuff on Earth, on Counter-Earth, you know, back, forth, left, right, I mean, all kinds of stuff. I'm hoping and expecting some other past Thunderbolts to eventually show up in this title, either as guest stars. I mean, for that, I'm thinking like Hawkeye and Songbird and a few other characters, although both of those, I guess, were in New Avengers recently. And a few as antagonists. Again, I'm thinking like Baron Zemo most likely there, and maybe one or two as just some new members.
Yeah. This is one that you know, it lets you have this built-in affinity for this team. I couldn't recommend as a new title for someone to check out. I don't think there's enough here to carve out a place on your pull list or even really sample unless you're really desperate. Didn't do much for me throughout. I actually have it as a C-. And I won't read another one probably.
I went with a B-, but I also went in knowing these characters and the backstory pretty well, and it probably got a bit of a benefit out of that. I think the C-, you're giving it that's reasonable. If you're into the Thunderbolts, the original version and stuff, this may be worth checking out. It's again not one that I either would recommend saying, "Oh, you've got to go find it and check it out." It's also one that I wouldn't say, oh my god, you've got to avoid it either. I think there are much stronger titles out there, but I think Jim Zub may just need a little bit of runway to kind of get things moving on this. He had to get the team, they were already together, but get them established, get them a headquarters, get them a little bit of a mission and kind of a little bit of a immediate threat and stuff. And I think all of that was accomplished here. So I felt there was enough going on to get the story really moving. But where I think we both felt it was lacking was getting people connected to the characters and caring about them. We'll see how it does. I don't think this is going to have anything of a run like the original did. But let's face it, that went, what did you say, 174 issues or some such?
Yeah, 176 it looks like.
176. Yeah, nothing runs that long these days. I mean, you could probably put together the total issue count of the last volume of everything at Marvel and have a lower total number of issues than that. Titles just turn over so fast these days.
Yeah.
So, be curious to see how well this gets received by the marketplace.
Yeah, I'm curious how many folks were missing this title, how many comic shop owners will put it on the shelves, and just on name recognition alone, and then I'm anxious to see what the drop-off is by issue 3 or 4.
No disrespect to this creative team, but this is a title they could have put some heavier hitters on, and it might have benefited.
Yeah.
Because it is something that's got some name recognition and some cachet to it, and they just kind of tossed it out there. Hey, here's another title. It's like, nah, you could have made a run with this.
Mm-hmm.
And I think with the Avengers not having a clear anchor book, same with the X-Men and a few other franchises, having just the single Thunderbolts book makes it the de facto leader of its own franchise. I mean, there was some possibility there.
Yeah. And there's no telling what could happen. It could right the ship. I mean, it was more of a misstep for me than it was for you. And so it might find an audience. I'm not seeing it right now, but we'll see.
Yeah. Shall we move on to our other book?
Yeah.
Now this is The Walking Dead, The Alien from Panel Syndicate. Normally Walking Dead is from Image, but this is by Brian K. Vaughan and Marcos Martin. They swung a deal with Robert Kirkman to kind of swap properties or whatever. How exactly did that go down? I'm forgetting at the moment.
In order for them to break their agreement to never print The Private Eye.
That's what it was.
They allowed Image to print The Private Eye, and in exchange, Brian K. Vaughan was allowed to write a Walking Dead story. And I think originally it was pitched as Kirkman would write a Walking Dead story for Panel Syndicate, and then it evolved into this, and which is also cool. This is what happens when you're up there in the Mount Rushmore area of creators. You get to play these sort of games and throw things around like this, and with these chess pieces. It's kind of fun.
If I'm not mistaken, this is the only Walking Dead comic book story that was not written by Robert Kirkman.
Yeah. So that's kind of a big deal.
Yeah, definitely. And hopefully it, you know, really raises the profile of Panel Syndicate. I think they're doing great stuff on their website.
From a traffic situation, I would think it would help immensely.
Yeah. Well, and again, that's the whole point. If you can get people to the website and they say, oh, let me check this. Oh, look at this other stuff.
Yeah. This one's free. Well, those were so good. I should give them a buck.
Yeah, or at least keep coming back. And you know, again, getting the awareness of PanelSyndicate.com up, that's a good thing. It benefits everybody. Brian K. Vaughan, Marcos Martin. It was a cool thing for Kirkman to swing this deal.
Yeah.
There were a couple of things about this that I thought were worth noting.
Yeah.
One, a fair amount of profanity in this. Not tons and tons and tons, but, you know, some. But that's not out of place for a Walking Dead comic.
It fits the universe, yeah.
Absolutely. And that's one thing this comic did perfectly, is it fit the universe. But it was also set in Barcelona, Spain. So it was in its own little corner, and it was not disconnected, though. You know, when we get this armored jouster on a moped, I'm like, that's just a cool visual. That works. What the heck's going on with it?
And that would be effective in the Walking Dead universe.
Absolutely. And she saves this guy. It's like, you have something I need. I'm like, does she know who this guy is? Do we know who this guy is? What does he have that she needs? Whatever. When we finally get the answer to that question, I'm like, that was a good answer.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a lot of good stuff here. I mean, this is it's definitely in Brian K. Vaughan's voice. And so it doesn't inhabit the tone that of Robert Kirkman's Walking Dead the same. It's obviously a foreigner writing in a place where they weren't born. You know what I mean?
I think setting it in Spain, featuring an American, kind of fits that aspect. In other words, there's an aspect of familiarity here.
Yeah.
It fit the tone and the style of the universe, but it was also different.
It's definitely a good comic. It's just Walking Dead is lock, stock, and barrel Robert Kirkman's vision. And if you had any doubt, read one of the other greatest writers of our day, Brian K. Vaughan, attempting to write his style and his version of that world, and you'll see it's not quite the same thing. And I'm sure it would be the same if Kirkman tried to write a Private Eye story or Why the Last Man story or something like that. But it's apples and oranges, I think.
I think that's a little bit of an unfair comparison, in so much as Kirkman is writing an ongoing story that's been ongoing for, 156 issues or some odd?
Mm-hmm.
This is a done-in-one story.
Yeah.
And it's a really good done-in-one story, and one that could fold back into the main Walking Dead title with some payoff down the line. Don't know if it will. Don't care if it does. If it does, awesome. If not, that's fine, too. And certainly you're right. Brian K. Vaughan puts his own flavor or accent on it, if you will. But to me, it read very much in the tone, the style, and the feeling of The Walking Dead. But not a Kirkman issue, because Kirkman is, again, playing the long game. They can't do that here. They have the issue. You know, and Kirkman really toys with the readers where, you know, hey, I'm going to go left, I'm going to go right. Oh, zing, boom. Surprised you. Did this. Didn't see that coming, did you? You know, he's really kind of almost poking and prodding at the audience, knowing where their head's going to be at, and then playing with that. And Vaughn didn't attempt to do that, didn't need to do that, because, again, he's got the single issue. He told, you know, get in, tell a story, get out. And I thought he did that really well.
Oh, yeah. I enjoyed this. I don't think it's anywhere near what Kirkman's command of the universe is. And it felt like it was a stranger trying to play in that world where they're not as comfortable.
Well, and it very much was that in reality. But I also think we've never seen Kirkman do this kind of standalone, done-in-one story in the Walking Dead universe.
That's probably true. I know there's been some, they took some liberties with some backup stories before, but I think they still had the main characters involved.
To me, the apples and oranges comparison is the fact that, again, one issue, ongoing story, that kind of stuff. The one question I had out of this, though, was, I mean, I've never been to Barcelona. I certainly have never been after a zombie, you know, apocalypse. But there are a couple of things I wouldn't think would be that hard to find around any modern civilized town. Yet a lot of the story seems to hinge on a certain thing, not, you know, this guy having and nobody else. That just felt a little odd.
Yeah.
I did like how it was tangentially connected to the main narrative of The Walking Dead, and in some ways very strongly. In other ways, again, it's its own story.
I think that connection is an enjoyable surprise that I don't think you'd be spoiled if you haven't read this. I think that needs to be organically read and enjoyed, or otherwise I think it loses a step, because it was spoiled for me, and so I really didn't get to enjoy that upturn, and I think it lost a little bit of luster because of that.
Interesting. What I liked was it connected in a fun but non-essential way.
Yeah.
If you don't catch the connection, you're not like, well, I don't get it. What's the point? You know, but if you do, it's like, oh, okay, that's interesting.
Yeah, it's a great addition.
It's Easter egg level almost.
And I think the end left you with a chance to. There's a possibility that this storyline could reconnect either in comic form or in one of the television series.
Oh, absolutely. Or, you know, somebody else could do continue on with this narrative, or, you know, others or whatever. You know, it was also, I think, the first time we've seen anything outside of, you know, the vicinity of the survivors we've been following in The Walking Dead.
Outside of the Telltale Game series, yeah.
I was thinking strictly in the comic stuff. So, yeah, I would exclude the Telltale Games, and I would exclude the TV stuff.
Those are canon.
Oh, I don't think so.
I think
not the TV show.
The Telltale games are part of his. I think those are all. He signed off on all those.
That may well be. I've read all the comics. I haven't read those, so I don't consider them canon.
Well, I guess if you don't consider them canon, then they can't be.
Well, I'm not saying that. I'm just saying it's to me. Once you start going transmedia, what you determine canon and stuff, that gets a little dicey pretty quick. Those may well be in continuity and stuff, but I can't speak to them because I've never played them.
They're awesome.
Cool. I'm not surprised. Again, this was an interesting extension of The Walking Dead. It was cool to see Brian K. Vaughan, Marcos Martin do this kind of a stuff. It had a nice blend of their kind of style and storytelling sensibilities and The Walking Dead. It worked really well for me in general. There were a couple of panels I thought were needlessly gross and disgusting. You could say, oh, but it's The Walking Dead. So, yeah, you didn't need to do that. Overall, though, I enjoyed this a lot, and I'm glad they got the opportunity to kind of play in this universe. I think that was a cool negotiating tactic of Kirkman's in order to get the Private Eye imprint.
It was interesting that we chose to review this on the week that an issue of The Walking Dead proper came out.
Mm-hmm.
Because it was a really cool one to punch there, and on the one hand they're just totally different, both fantastic reads on their own merits, and tangentially they have these connections, but yet they're so different, and but yet are part of the same whole. So it was really a cool week for us to choose to do this. And, I thought that was kind of an extra effective layer there.
Well, I also liked how this proved that The Walking Dead, while this great epic saga, there's also short story format viability to it.
Yeah. And we, I don't know if in the comic books we ever knew if it was just isolated to Georgia, you know, or the East Coast or whatever. And this kind of shows that it's a worldwide phenomenon.
Yeah, this is the first confirmation of that. There had been rumors, speculation, some stuff like that, but nothing.
Yeah, we had some characters that came from Texas, I think, which is about as far as we've gotten away from Georgia, right?
Well, and then there was the boat that was going out or whatever. I don't know. There were a few things where people went off to go see if there was other stuff.
Yeah.
But we'd never heard anybody report back. And even if we did, well, that's what they said, not what we saw. So, again, cool expansion of the universe. Fun stuff. For me, I gave it a B+. I thought it was a lot of fun. Did a good job. You know, and I don't know that I need to see everybody playing in this universe. But, you know, it was fun to see somebody else play in it and tell a good story.
Yeah, I'm at the exact same score. I liked it a lot. Thought it was a B+. And, well worth reading if you enjoy Walking Dead and want to get a little bonus material. I don't know if this should be your first experience with Walking Dead. I think that's first trade is still the way to go to enjoy Walking Dead in comic format. And this is a kind of just a bonus material for later.
I would start with the first trade. No question about that. I could see doing this either as you know, a quick aside after that.
After that first trade would be a nice place to shoehorn this in.
Because there's a tangential connection at that point, I think. It's a good side story.
Mm-hmm.
So, man, this was another sizable week for me with somewhere around 50 or so comics. I am current on my reading still. Was not easy.
Tons of good stuff came out this week. I love that new Aftershock Genesis sampler for a buck. It was just full of stuff. Prequel things and unreleased material and, you know, samples of all the different line. Really a nice title that you can check out some of the things. I think I would have probably put it out a few weeks ago.
Would have even gone maybe a few months ago. That's something that I think they should have done, potentially something of that sort when they launched.
Yeah. Yeah. And it, or at least after the first wave maybe came out and then you could put this out, but it would have fit a little longer ago, I think, a little better, but I like the attempt. I always like dollar comics as entryways. Mm-hmm. And this sampler was a really good choice for them to do so.
Have you been reading the Bruce Lee, The Dragon Rises comic from Darby Pop?
No.
Second issue came out. I'm really enjoying that title. The basic premise is we all know that Bruce Lee's been gone for quite some time. He comes back, hasn't aged a day, doesn't remember anything in the last 40 years since he's been gone. We think he died. He didn't. Or maybe he did and got better. Don't know. A little unclear. But we see how he kind of comes back and stuff. And it's fun because he's Bruce Lee, but he doesn't kind of really... I mean, he knows his name is Bruce Lee. He doesn't know he's the Bruce Lee or what that means in society. So there's a fun aspect there to be had. It's got a good art style that fits the book.
So like a 5 or 6 issue miniseries?
I think it's an ongoing. I'm not sure.
Oh, I can't imagine that premise holding up that long.
Oh, I can. I think it'll tweak and change. But, you know, modern day Bruce Lee stories, that I could think could go for quite some time.
Hmm.
It has a fun sensibility to it, where he's kind of rediscovering himself in some respects. So I'm really enjoying it. It's working really well. And then Flash 51, we talked about issue 50 and stuff. The whole concept of the Riddler deciding to defeat the Flash by outthinking him. I don't think they really sold that well in issue 50. I thought they sold it well here. It was an interesting concept and a lot of fun. Of course, there's, one more issue, and then we rebirth the title.
Yeah, really playing out the string on some of these. And I've kind of jumped off ship on a lot of those early just because... You know, they weren't that great to begin with, so I really don't need to see how they end up. So I'm putting a lot of my chips in the rebirth basket, hoping to get reengaged with some of the DC titles that I wasn't engaged with.
I think DC's putting a lot in that basket, hoping people get reengaged with titles they weren't getting engaged with. And man, I hope that happens. I am not convinced that they are tackling the core problems that in my perception as an outsider. I think they might be having a DC. I think they're saying, oh, well, you know, we drifted away from what people expected and we need to bring back stuff that we jettisoned in the new 52. I think that's not a bad move, but it seems like things really went awry during the new 52. And that to me seems to be a reflection of the current editorial strength or lack thereof over at DC. You know, if things are not, are being referred to as having gone awry, off message, you know, whatever terminology exactly they're using, but, you know, things have gone wrong. Well, isn't the editor's job to make sure that doesn't happen?
Yeah.
You know, a good editor in chief would be doing the stuff that apparently Geoff Johns is doing of talking with all the creators, getting stuff back to the, I don't say the back to the basics, back to fundamentals, but back on message, if you will. What are these characters? What should they be, etc.? And if they haven't coupled all of that with a solidification of editorial policies, practices, and mindset, how are we not going to need to rebirth this rebirthing, you know, in another couple of years or sooner?
Yeah, and who'll be left at that point?
I mean, I really want to buy into this. I'm liking some of what they're doing, but every time I hear they're trying to you know, bring back the people they've lost and get things, you know, back on track or whatever. I want to believe, I think they can. I think they've got some good creators. I think they've got great properties. I think they've got some good people in Jim Lee, Jeff Johns, Dan Didio. I believe they've got the right intent. But again, why should this time be any different? How are they going to execute on this? How are we not going to get back into the same thing? Mm-hmm. And when I hear the, you know, oh, well, you know, we drifted from what the characters truly are, what people connect with, at the same time, they're doing Scooby Apocalypse, which seems to be a pretty major departure from the classic Scooby-Doo stuff like we were just reading in Scooby-Doo Team-Up. I'm like, whoa, wait a sec. I know you're not getting rid of the Scooby-Doo Team-Up and those things, but on the one hand, you're trying to take those characters and put them in a bold, new, exciting direction, while admitting the bold, new, exciting direction you were trying on the superhero stuff didn't work. It's a very mixed message for me, and I'm puzzled. I'm hoping that they have great success with this, but I'm waiting to see it happen.
Yeah. Yeah, I think we all are. And I think we're all rooting for them. We hope they do that.
Oh, absolutely.
The good folks at Rough Riders heard what you said. And in their second issue, they finished putting the whole gang together. They sped it up. It wasn't going to take that whole arc. So
not only that, they even kicked one off.
Yeah. Yeah. So they heard, took your notes, and they put them in action, which I thought was nice.
Yeah, I was surprised how much the story kind of sped up and stuff. That worked a lot better for me than the first issue did.
I think there's a lot of potential there for that, and it's been a fun couple of issues. I've really enjoyed it. The Wiccan and Divine has really kind of righted the ship for me. They took some time off. The artist took some time off to do the Phonogram third volume,
mm-hmm.
and during that 6 issues or so, they had guest fill-in artists, and Kieran Gillen was just kind of treading water, and it really suffered. And now that Phonogram's over and Gillen and Kelvey are back together, these last couple of issues have been really good, really strong again. The story has direction, and it's much higher quality. So next time you want to do a passion project, just go on hiatus and don't derail. This book needs both creators on it.
I agree with it. Agree with you in that entirely. How do you think it would have played out if they had, between say 6 issue arcs or whatever, taken a month or two off, gotten maybe the first part of Phonogram, you know, issue or two in the can, done that second arc, got the next you know, issue or two, and kind of piecemealed up Phonogram that way for that third volume, to where they could have had it coming out concurrently with an arc of Wicked and Divine?
I think it would have been, I mean, they didn't lose anything, because I think McKelvey still did a page or two in each issue. So he's still getting credit for being an artist on the book, but they just really lost their way for that 6 issue arc. I felt.
Well, that's my point, is they could have done it without losing their way if they had basically done kind of the saga model and planned out what they would mm-hmm. do during kind of those breaks.
Yeah, I don't know what the financial ramifications of that would be, and if they could afford to do that, but I'm not sure.
Don't know. I mean, they wouldn't have. I don't know. It would have been an interesting approach to take, to where they could be doing kind of that passion project while still mm-hmm. doing this ongoing series and such.
Ed Brubaker's The Violent at Image is ending at issue 5. So sales were not there. In the letters column, he seemed pretty upset about it, that his comic is ending before he's done telling the story.
Do you think he might get violent? No, I'm kidding.
if this book is have any glimpse into his psyche, then that's quite a chance of that. But so this thing is ending next issue. I'm not sure how they're going to tie it all up. There's a lot of stuff to do, and the creators are talking about maybe doing a trade paperback follow up where they don't try to do the single issues and maybe tell their story that way. But it seemed like they were pretty much just down about the whole thing. Sales just weren't there.
I can understand being unhappy about that, but that's kind of the market we live in these days.
Well, yeah, you and I were both in the panel from the guy at Comics Experience, where he kind of laid out the arc.
Oh, yeah.
You're losing money at issue 5, you know, you start at X number, then by 5, you know, you're taking away. Maybe might have been by 4 you were losing money.
Hang on. I actually have my notes from that panel.
right there?
Right there on my desk.
It's either you don't clean often or you anticipated my every whim.
We're going to go with I anticipated. It's not true, but that's what we're going with. So let's see. Comic Experience, Andy Schmidt. And basically what he was saying is... Figure, you got whatever your issue one sales are, 40% drop to number 2, 30% drop to number 3, 20% drop to number 4, 10% drop to number 5. So if you start, say, at 100 copies, you're down to like 29 by number 5. Now,
yeah, and that's you need 50 to break even.
That's what he's saying for the stuff they've done. The numbers I look at tend to be, obviously across, including Marvel, DC, a broader spectrum. Mm-hmm. But he walked through the math in the panel on basically, it costs you so much to do this, let's work the numbers. By the 5th issue, you've lost money than if you just stopped at 4.
Yeah.
And it's brutal math, but it's kind of the way some of the stuff works out.
To the point where he said, if somebody comes to me with an 8-issue arc, and that might have been a different panel, can you tell it in 4?
Did 2 panels that had similar overlap and stuff. And yeah, there was, can you tell it faster and stuff? Because by 8, you would be, losing all the money
you
would
have. Lost everything that you gained.
Yeah.
And this is, of course, this doesn't count the outliers. If you're selling 50,000 copies a month, of course, it's not the same way. We're talking about the back half playing field.
I was going to say, if you're selling the 50,000, you're not going through Comics Experience.
Yes. Yeah, you're and
established pro at that point.
And not even all of the Image play on the same playing field, but some of them do. Some of them do live down in this area. And so it's sad when they don't get to tell the story they want to tell and the sales don't reflect that. So
but the thing is, they can tell the story they want to tell. They would just have to pony up the cash. And that's harsh. That's unfortunate. I'm not saying I like where the sales levels are. I don't. I think it's atrocious. But when you've got the lead guys, the head guys at DC saying, well, we've got to rebuild our fan base because we've kind of squandered it. What hope do the little guys have?
Yeah, I mean, the DC has the luxury for the most part, as does Marvel for the most part, that it doesn't matter what they put out. They're going to sell 40,000 issues of the first one. And
we no longer live in that world. Rebirth is happening because DC, Dan Didio and Jim Lee realized they can't and shouldn't do that. It does matter what they publish. They need to focus on the content.
I still think, I know there's a couple of low selling Marvel titles and a couple of really low selling DC titles, but I think you could just go back 10 years and just dust those off and start over again. And I think you could do the churn for a while. They've done it for a while.
But DC's changing game plans. That's why they're going bi-monthly on certain, or bi-weekly or whatever, every other week on some books. They're basically saying, let's do, instead of doing something like a Gotham by Midnight or whatever, let's do 2 Batmans. Maybe we tell the story in there. Let's focus on fewer titles that are better selling.
I think that's a good idea, too. I think that's a good
model. It's got pros and cons. We'll see if it works. I've got very mixed feelings about the speed with which Marvel's coming out with a lot of their titles. No sooner have I read one than the next one shows up. It accelerates the pace, which can be a good thing. It can also burn out readers.
One of the things that you kind of lose that Snyder Capullo team vision for a book, and it becomes more of a editor driven title because you might be able to keep the writer going on those. They might need breaks as well, but you definitely can't keep an artist doing a book every 2 weeks.
No, and you've got to deal with the art in different ways and stuff. Obviously, you're going to almost be alternating every other issue. But I think DC has proven with things like the 52 weekly series, you can get a couple of writers, get them working in tandem, telling a cohesive story around the same vision.
Yeah, yeah.
It can work.
It can work.
but it's a challenge.
I don't think you would ever confuse the weekly series with the quality of Batman. That was a singular vision of two creators.
Batman, though, was an outlier compared to most of the other books DC was publishing.
Yeah. I'm struggling to come up with any kind of example that has more than a handful of issues to give you. I would say Lois and Clark is one of them that's very strong, and you can see it's a creative vision there, but there's not very many that I can point to.
Yeah, and you know, I'm agreeing with what you're saying. It's just a matter of that's one title. You know what I mean? And
yeah,
that's part of why DC is doing the rebirth. They got to right the ship. They got to get back on a good direction. The question is, do they know what a good direction is? And can they both, if they do, get on that track and stay on that track?
Yeah.
And I'm looking at what Marvel's doing. Sure, they got a couple of missteps here and there. Thunderbolts could have been a home run. It wasn't. You know, they've got some other stuff here and there that's working better for some people than others. One or two, what I would consider personally, I know other people disagree, train wrecks like, you know, the X-Men 92 or whatever. But they also have a number of things that are really doing fairly well for them. DC's just not got kind of that batting average across the line right now. I think we're looking towards, you know, once the DC rebirth comes out on the 25th, you know, it's potentially a new game for DC. It's just a question of, do they have a good game plan? Do they have the ability to execute on it? Or is it, yeah, well, that was good hype. Oh, well, what's Marvel doing? Or Image or IDW or, you know, whoever. I think we're in for a very interesting few months coming up with Rebirth. I'm just hoping it's pleasant surprises and knocking things out of the park versus, wow, that's a shame. So we'll see.
Yeah, I'm curious to see what they do with Amanda Connor and Jimmy Palmiotti now that I think they're both exclusive to DC now, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I'd kind of like to see what they do with them outside of Harley Quinn.
That is one of the things they did of lock up a lot of creators to get kind of their full mm-hmm. attention and efforts, which I thought was a smart move and a good way to treat the creators.
Tom King was a good buy there. I think he'll have some quality work. And of course, Snyder's not going anywhere. He's just going to take a little break and come back with All-Star Batman and Robin. All-Star Batman,
I think. But I guess my question is it a problem of having not had the right creators or having not given them the right marching orders and direction through editorial?
Yeah, I get that scuttlebutt, and it's the whispers that the editorial drove away the good talent.
I'm not even saying they drove away the good talent. When I hear Jim Lee and Dan Didio saying, you know, Green Lantern being a criminal, that shouldn't have happened. The robot Batman thing lasted too long. People didn't connect with the Jean Superman and stuff like this. Things got off message. They're not telling the stories they feel they should be telling, not the tone, the style, the take on the characters. To me, that's a direct indictment of your editorial staff. They let things go amok. So
yeah, and I don't know if you're a comic book writer and you get paid not by the idea but by the page.
Mm-hmm.
You have a great story idea. Do you tell it in two or do you tell it in 6 or 12? Because it's a great idea and you can make a lot more money with it if you stretch that sucker out.
It's something where I think is I'm all for Geoff Johns working with the creators. What's the core of the character, the direction to go with, that kind of stuff. I think that's awesome. But until you've figured out those kinds of, hey, should an editor be saying, you know, maybe that's a 2-issue story.
Yeah, maybe the rot doesn't need to go on for 24 issues or however long it went. You know, those sort of things alienated even diehard fans of titles.
But
you know,
the editor is on the front line of that battle. They are the spokesperson to the creator for the company and such. And when you've got the higher up saying, hey, they didn't do the right thing.
Yeah.
I'm not saying it's necessarily the editor's fault. It could be that the higher-ups didn't communicate clearly to the editors.
Yeah,
I am saying there is a problem to be had.
That's my solved. My understanding is editors are middle managers that are over top of the creators and should be able to influence decisions like length of story arc and tone and subject matter and things if it doesn't fit the overall company focus. But I'm not sure if that's the truth or not at DC. But that's my understanding of what it should be.
If it's not, why not?
Yeah.
And are they doing anything around those sorts of issues? Again, we will know over the coming months.
Yeah.
I'm looking forward to seeing what happens. I just think that, again, some of the what I'm hearing about Rebirth and what I'm seeing about how they're doing some of the Hanna-Barbera stuff just seems mutually, not mutually exclusive, but philosophically divergent.
And, you know, we're committed to supporting this Rebirth here at the Weekly Comic Spotlight. We're going to be reviewing a lot of those titles. We're going to be reading a lot of those titles and talking about them because we want them to succeed.
So absolutely.
It's not like we're crapping all over DC because, you know, Convergence was the last straw. This one might be the last straw, but we want them to succeed. So we're going to give them all a shot.
To me, it's a question of identifying what is the core problem they're having, because they are some great people over at DC. They've got some great characters, great talent, great people, both in editorial, marketing, the higher ups, etc.
Yeah.
Yet they're having a problem getting their line to really pull together and move forward. And the question is why? And I think once they can identify that and do something about it, Marvel's going to get a run for their money. And I think that's good for the industry.
They've got the greatest library of characters. And we see that on a week-to-week basis in some of their television properties.
Yeah.
And the way they can pull these characters out and for the small screen and just electrify you as a viewer and excite you as a viewer to come back the next week. And then, you know, it's tougher to do when you stretch in that same idea over six months, and say maybe it could be told a little more tidy. And I think we both think that maybe an editor can help with that.
Yeah, no, totally. And I mean, they know how to tell tighter stories, do stuff like that. We see it in Injustice Gods Among Us and some other titles. I would say even the Scooby-Doo team-up we just talked about.
Yeah.
So it's just a question of they need to identify where they should be focusing and get some game plans in place. I think they've done some of that. I just question if they've done it in all the areas they need to or not. And again, we'll see what happens. I think DC Rebirth in a couple of weeks, that's going to set the tone, at least for me, for you know, what my expectations are of the DC superhero universe for the next couple of months to a year, or however long that trajectory kind of lasts.
Yeah, I think that title, that kickoff title, the 80-page giant there is going to be a real indicator of where we're at. And I hope I'm super jazzed and pumped when I get done reading that.
Oh, same here.
And that'll be great if that's the case.
They need that. They deserve that.
Mm-hmm.
So, anything else? Are we pretty much done?
Yeah, we better stop talking. It's been a while.
All right, then.
Join us next week as we discuss Batman Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles number 6 from DC, All New All Different Avengers number 9 from Marvel, and Stargate Atlantis Back to Pegasus number 6 from American Mythology.
The show notes and forum for this podcast can be found at www.comicbookpage.com under the podcast and forum sections of the website. Please email us at theguys@comicbookpage.com and let us know what you think of what was discussed in this episode. Thanks for listening.